Hello, movie fans. Dimitri Panos here on the Popcorn Talk Network's Anatomy of a Movie, where today we discuss Robert Zemeckis' 18th movie, Allied. See you soon.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Anatomy of a Movie.
Well, hello, movie fans. Again, this is Dimitri Panos from the Popcorn Talk Network, Anatomy of a Movie, and I'm joined with the person who we started it all, Marissa Serafini. Hey,
hello,
Marissa.
Hello, Dimitri. Hello, everybody. Yes, I'm Marissa Serafini. You can follow me on Twitter at SerafiniTV.
And you can support me if you choose on Twitter at DMovies1701. Now that we've gotten that out of the way, we are today talking about Robert Zemeckis, great director Robert Zemeckis, his 18th movie.
Wow.
He's
had quite the career.
Quite an amazing career. I mean, he could have stopped at three movies.
Right.
But
those three movies.
Thank God he continued on. And this movie is a throwback World War II romantic spy thriller called Allied, starring Brad Pitt and Marion Cotillard.
Trying to do it with a French accent.
I can't do it. Just like Brad Pitt's French accent was off. There's no way. in any case, as we always start the show off, we talk about what we thought about it. So, Marissa, please.
You know what? There were some things about this movie that I really enjoyed and some things that I not so much. Robert Zemeckis, I was, like, really looking forward to this one. And it looked great, despite all the scandal that's going on behind the scenes with this film. You know, I thought the concept was great. Always the spy thriller kind of who do we trust in your relationship. I thought that was a great concept to go about. And, I mean, Brad Pitt and Marion Cotillard, they are both so well-renowned as actors themselves individually. Put them together, and it's going to be amazing. Mm-hmm. And I love any World War II story. You know me. We've covered a lot of World War II movies here. So anything World War II time era fascinates me, no matter what it is. And so I thought they got the period down beautifully. It looked great. I think the storyline is where it kind of fell a little flat for me, more so. I mean, we had the story of, you know, hey, she's a spy, the wife is a spy, but like, other than that, what else happens? I don't think it was too simple of a storyline for me to constantly keep engaged for this movie for 2 hours.
Interesting. Okay. You know, for me, and I'm gonna put my geeking hat on for a second, so it's definitely a throwback World War II spy thriller, and it has its nods to films of a different era. Things like, you know, Saboteur, Under Suspicion, Eye of the Needle, and of course Casablanca.
I love Casablanca.
And of course Casablanca, and there was even a little bit of Lawrence of Arabia to be found in Allied. All great. Don't overpower the movie. They don't take over the movie. They're just nice, subtle nods to previous films of a different era, in which this movie was really made, you know, cut from the cloth of those various other movies. You know, yet for me, even though it was beautifully shot, handily directed by Robert Zemeckis, and he worked very hard to try and build suspense. But personally, I thought it was script coupled with some performance that they give away the spy. Like there are some great plot points, but there weren't enough. If you're gonna have a spy thriller, there weren't enough MacGuffins or misdirections to get off the point. And here, spoiler: we are a very spoiler-rich movie. That pointed direction away from Marion Cotillard's character as being the spy. Like, I sort of kind of knew from listening to her dialogue and such that, and knowing what the story was about, that she was the spy. Mm-hmm. And that sort of kind of took away some of the suspense of the movie for me. But yet, I thought that, as you were saying, that in their own right, they're really solid actors. putting them together, I think it was a really good pairing. And I found that there was definitely kindling for that fire, but it didn't blossom for me. Like, I didn't mind them together, but I also didn't think that there was the heavy passion chemistry either. And I think it might have been the choice, like, maybe the way Brad Pitt seemed a little bit subtle, almost too subtle. And Marion, her character, Marion, was a little bit cold. And everything seemed to be almost calculated. And we'll get to certain plot points, like when she was having the baby, which, beautiful, amazing scene, right?
Yeah.
Totally original. Course, yes. I've never seen it. So we'll talk about that a little bit later. And, you know, one thing that you mentioned, too, is how beautifully this movie looked. I have to shout out, because this woman, if you watch this show, this woman is very near and dear to my heart, because I worked as part of her team my first job when I moved to L.A., and that's costume designer, Academy Award nominee costume designer Joanna Johnston. Mm-hmm. And I have to give her a shout out, because her costumes capture the period and showcase that even in wartime, people looked Vogue. Like, they looked stunning in what they wore. And it wasn't flashy stunning. It was that period, which I love the style of that period. So the movie looked good, even from a costume standpoint. So which we'll talk about the detailing.
Absolutely. I think visually and like all the technical aspects of this film, I think we're like really up to par. I think the stories was like probably the part where I had the most, I don't want to say issues, but like where I found lacking a little bit.
Whereabouts.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, whereabouts.
Well, the storyline, I mean, we get these two paired together on a assignment.
Right.
And that takes up the first probably good solid 40, 45 minutes of the movie. And it was kind of like a big climactic scene once they take out the German ambassador.
Right.
And then afterwards, you're like, okay, what else happens? Like, they work together, and then thanks to the trailer, and anyone who's going into this movie who knows what it's about, we know that they get married, your wife is a spy. And then the rest of the movie is like, okay, we know she's a spy. Now let's get to it.
Yeah.
I think it was just too slow of a burn to watch Max Vitan find out all these things about his wife just to confirm that she's a spy.
Yeah, I mean, his hunt for this is, you know, trying to figure that out. I thought that was perhaps one of the more interesting parts. I want to go back to the set piece that you mentioned at the beginning of in the first half of the movie. I want to ask you, and I'm going to leave this out to the audience as well to comment on, did you find that it was all too easy? Like, they seemed to just, like...
What was all too easy?
They
Their assignment?
Well, not the assignment. The assignment sounds very hard.
Mm-hmm.
The way they carried it off and then got away, it seemed a little bit easy. Like, they shot them? And then they're out the door in a car and they're out and nobody
done.
Chased them. I couldn't help but think of the scene that took place in Inglourious Bastards when they were in the theater, also starring Brad Pitt, you know, and killing Hitler. Those guys had a harder time trying to get out of that theater.
Yeah.
And again, I know he was just a Nazi ambassador, which we learn later on. He was not a Hitler sympathizer. He was a Hitler dissident. So maybe that was why it was so easy for them to get out. But the first thing I thought of was there was no car chase. There was like they just walked out.
They literally walked out at a brisk pace, they walked. They literally walked out,
got into the car, drove away. He proposed.
Done.
I was like, okay.
Like, I'm in love with you. We just did some action climactic scene. Let's get married.
Yeah. And again, beautifully rendered and shot.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I thought it was too easy as well. I think the cool thing that like actually got me engaged in the film is that, okay, they're both on this assignment. They're meeting each other for the first time. They have to go through all these obstacles just to get to the party that had the person that they were, you know, assigned to kill
right
out. It's like, I thought that was cool, how they had to work together for the first time and kind of build their relationship between those two. But then after that, I'm like, what else can happen? What else can be as climactic as this right now? And that was in the first 45 minutes.
Yeah, I don't disagree. And also, I'm going to throw in there, too, their first meeting when he walked in and they were at the nightclub and he sees it for the first time. That, to me, is the scene where, for me, they at least had the most spark. Like, she turns around and has the smile, and they did sell it that they were a couple that had been together for some time. And to me, like, later on down the movie, it never seemed to reach that pitch for me.
It was like the stakes weren't as high to make it believable.
Yeah. And for me, it was like a little bit story-wise. Well, you said it was like a little bit too simple. Like, the department that Brad Pitt works for is a very thorough researched department. So when they brought Brad Pitt in to break the news, you know, it's a very interesting scene. But that's where they mention, oh, and by the way, is that Nazi ambassador that you killed? Well, he was not a Hitler sympathizer. He was a dissident, and that's why he was killed. And I was like going, how did you, A, miss that minor detail?
Right.
And B, now you're bringing it up? Like, you, I mean, because in a sense, then that mission was sort of a failure from the Allies' point of view.
Yeah, because they just lost the people he just worked with.
Yeah. Like, how did you miss that detail?
See, that I think that was also my issue. I think that it's good that you bring that up too, because it seems that there were so many discrepancies and inconsistent with the people he was working for.
Yeah.
I'm like, how trustworthy are they if they keep missing all these big points in their life? Like, they even said in the movie that it's like, went through a very thorough vetting system, and they went to, you know, look over Marianne Bouzajour's background just to get approved to go to a new country.
Yeah.
And so, like, we get the idea that they did a background check on her, she approved, but, like, how thorough was that background check? If they made a mistake about her, and then they also made a mistake about the mission ambassador that they were on.
Yeah, yeah, who ends up being an ally.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Which, you killed our, like, that was actually a friendly fire.
Yeah.
Instead of an enemy fire.
There's nothing friendly about that fire. I mean, that was a great scene. But, you know, so that was, like, number, like, that was a scene that I was like, well, how did they not know? And my other thing about Marianne's character, too, is she was a very thorough character herself. Mm-hmm. And that she was even coaching, you know, Brad Pitt's character, right? She was coaching Max. That's how thorough she was. But she didn't learn how to play piano?
I know. Again,
I was like, it was a really swell plot point when we find out, no, yeah, that looks exactly like her, and she does wonderful paintings. What kind of paintings? Watercolors. What kind of... And you're like, oh, okay. She goes, and she plays the piano beautifully, and you're...
she forgot something. Well, also because that shows, like, yeah, she knew certain aspects of the previous Marianne Bouzajour's life, but she didn't learn it all. And or maybe she just, like, refused to learn the piano after all these years. You think she'd be in front of a piano and someone might ask her. But also that goes to show with Max Vatan's character, where once they're trying to get the invitation to the party, and the guy's like, write down the chemical
phosphate.
Like, he was well researched. He knew what he was doing. Like, he knew this type of person would need to know this type of information. Yeah. And the fact that she didn't learn piano kind of bothers me.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, you bring up a real... That was a great scene.
That was great.
By the way.
The whole cutting in the deck was cool.
The whole cutting in the deck.
But, like, it also shows, like, his character was well researched, really took the time to learn exactly what he needed to play the part.
Yeah. Like a good spy. Yeah. And she did up to this one minor detail. That ended up being the...
Minor.
Well, that's true. It ended up being the detail that... pulled the thread on her, on everything. Yeah, and so those were certain details that I sort of kind of found, like, just interesting, because, again, if I know she's a spy, and through her dialogue at the very beginning, he was like, wow, it really looks like you love these people. When they're in the car, she goes, well, I play to their feelings. I have to make it real. And, you know, and then she said, I actually do like them, but that's how I get my job done. I have to play to their feelings. So automatically I'm on edge when I hear that dialogue because I'm like going, okay, she going to play to his feelings and how is this going to wrap out? And then she said during the scene, the birth scene, which we'll talk about, we might as well do it now. She says, this is the person who I am. And I'm thinking, you're a person who's in constant unnerving pain.
You're in labor right now.
This is the truth. This is what you're seeing. What you're seeing is like real. And I'm like going, well, if that's real, then wait, what does that mean? So there wasn't enough distraction. Like they tried, like, you know, they tried to set up distraction, but I don't know. Ultimately, it didn't end. It didn't work for me. But let's talk about that scene. Because writer Stephen Knight says, you know, in Allied, we haven't seen in recent history that there were scenes that we haven't seen in a while or ever. And one of them is that birthing scene. And he was like, well,
during an air raid.
During an air raid.
No less.
And he goes, and Stephen Knight goes on to say, and this comes from Slash Film, you know, as you go through writing the script, you have these, not a problem, but you have, okay, this has got to get done. You've got to go from the wedding to them waking up with a baby. What happens in between? Well, she's got to have the baby. It's got to be wartime. So you could just see her giving birth. Then the hospital in Hampstead is bombed. Okay, so where they live. So why not have that? It's an air raid and it's a birth and it's everything. Just bring it all in because that's what's great about having a bigger budget. You know how you can do it in Robert Zemeckis. Execution is going to look incredible, which it did.
Okay.
I mean, that scene amidst all this mayhem that's going on around them, you know, and then she's giving birth like outside with tracers and explosions.
Yeah,
and
it was a beautiful disaster.
Yeah.
That's what it was.
And you know what else I appreciated about this film too, is that Zemeckis purposely wanted to stay away from scenes that we've seen in other World War II in England. Like he said, I didn't want to show Big Ben. I didn't want to show like those balloons, the Zeppelins around Big Ben and things like that. So he did. I mean, to great success, we did see different aspects of England, of that wartime, and he sure did make it look and sound real. I mean, it sounded amazing.
I felt like I was getting bombed.
Yeah.
Like, I would not want to be like, anywhere where those guys were.
Yeah.
It looked beautiful. It sounded great. I think the whole birthing scene was kind of cool because I thought actually it was going to go longer, but that was like a quick 3 minutes on screen.
Yeah.
But it was impactful because it showed that this was the first time they were like truly, I think, on screen. Like their love brought them together and they're now starting a family in amidst this chaos. Shows that they really are just together in the war.
Yeah.
And like, I think that was the moment where, like, I truly believe that they, like, were in love as a couple, husband and wife, and soon to be parents.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a really great scene. Another scene that I found very interesting and that came up often was the party scene.
Like, there they had the party scene. There's a few parties in
this
scene.
Well,
in this movie.
Okay. The party scene at the house. Like, that
during
big
the second air raid?
Yeah. And it has been described, it was as very bohemian, which I found interesting.
Oh,
and they found interesting
in the closet and stuff, that one.
Yeah, that's the one that they're like the house party, because it's sort of, you know, much research was actually done regarding that party, and we all see Britain in English as being very stolid and being very, you know, emotion, like just we're going to get through this, you know. This party shows a side that we've really never seen in film during a war movie, in that they were living life day by day, not knowing if and when that a bomb was going to have their name on it. So they were living this this life where there was a lot of sex and cocaine and drugs and just like, hey, I got to do this day by day. I found that a very interesting. I found it very interesting that it came a lot of, that it came up a lot in the research that I was doing, that the party was a very important aspect of the movie. What I didn't understand, I'm going to throw this question out to you, is what do you think the importance was that Max had to invite his sister to the party, Lizzie Kaplan?
Oh, Lizzie. I don't think she needed to be there, but I think it was more so because this was at the point where he is under the mission of finding out the truth about his wife. And the character Lizzie Kaplan played, Bridget Vaitan, his sister, was like the out and proud lesbian at the time.
Right.
And the only family other than his wife that he could trust, quote unquote. So I think it was more so like he had to have someone also there by his side that he could tell literally anything to and trust other than his wife.
Okay.
And at the party, and it feels like that was kind of her kind of scene as well. Like, that was her environment, her people that she can easily get along with.
Yeah, but he made it out, like, because they had other plans, they were going to go somewhere else, but he said, listen, I really, it's very important that you come. And I found it sort of odd that...
Moral support.
Okay. You know,
I think it was more support because he literally just got the mission
right.
to find out about his wife. And then he goes over to his sister and be like, they're blue dying.
And he divulges classified information to her.
Yeah. So but I think it's like he just wanted family there.
Okay. Gotcha.
To support. Because
I was like, the way, you know, I was just, maybe I was overanalyzing because it was like, how did that move the plot? Like, what did she do to confirm or deny whatever suspicions, because I thought that's what he brought her over for. It's like, listen, I need your help. You got to be there for
the
support. I want, maybe from your angle, you can try to vet something out, but that never really happened, you know, so.
I mean, just found Lizzie Kaplan, she's a good actress, and we know that she's been on a lot and can accomplish a lot. And I was just kind of sad that we didn't see more of her character.
Agreed.
Like, I felt it was, like, underutilized.
And I guess that's what I was getting at. Like, I thought there was going to be more of her.
Than her
and
two
again,
scenes that she was there.
Wouldn't that have set up a little more suspense had our main character's sister found a thread to pull on? And does some investigating of her own.
And, like, from a woman to a woman finding out something, too. I think that just adds a whole nother dynamic to figuring out who Marianne Bouzé-Jour is.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And still, as we talk about the party, then comes the other scene, which they tried to set up as a MacGuffin, where Max sees Mary talking to this gentleman who looked very, like,
shady.
German... evil scientist with his beard, and you know, he's like, he's a jeweler.
Shady.
And he was selling me a brochure, but I'm watching it going,
a brooch.
I was like, yeah, I'm not buying it. I didn't buy that.
I was like,
you know, I wasn't buying it, so that at the end, when it comes out that he was part of her network, I was like, yeah, of course he was.
Of course he was. But which was also upsetting about his character is, like, they already set it up that we know that she's working with him, but by the time of his death at the end, we didn't even see it. The audience didn't see it. We only saw gunshots, flashes off to the side, and it was implied that Max shot him. But, like, his character didn't even, was like, yeah, he helped, but in what way? In what way other than being another person in England to help her?
Yeah, I think it was part of the network. The way that I read that scene that you're talking about, they pull up in front.
Mm-hmm.
Max has vetted out and is killing
the longest wait.
He's killing that network. And he goes up there, but I think the purpose may have been to set up some semblance of suspense where, like, because she was getting ready to run, where Max had gotten killed. Because it took an overlong time.
Too long of a time.
You know, to before anything happened, and she was getting nervous that me... And then when the gunshots went off, the character didn't know who it was that was shooting the gun. And hence she was ready to run, and then she sees Max come out. But I'm with you. I didn't believe that.
Like, his character had no reward at the end. Like, right. Why bring him up just to say that he helped her along all these years just to kill him off and we didn't even see it?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you take him out of this movie,
right,
you don't change anything. Nothing changes.
Yep.
So I feel like it was a waste of time building up a character where nothing happened with.
Yeah. No, it was just one of those things that it's part of the story. Maybe in simpler times, like, I think this movie would have worked better even 10 years ago, you know, than like, say, today. You know, I applaud it for being original. I applaud it for being this throwback. I applaud it for even being a beautiful period piece that's a World War II thriller that, you know, I mean, I'm with you. I think those movies can be a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
This movie had moments of it, but I wanted a little bit more. So, do you have any information regarding Stephen Knight, the writing of, like, what inspired him and or...
Oh, yeah.
What was the process and...
The development for this movie that Stephen Knight actually knew about this story is, he says, quote, unquote, "The story of the movie Allied has been sitting outside my office door like a stray dog for 30 years waiting to get made." And he found it while he was in the U.S. in the early 80s. So this is how long it's been for him. And when he was graduating college back in the 80s. And he just knew about this story. And it's kind of actually based on a true story of a man suspecting his wife was a German spy. And actually the real story ends up that he had to shoot her. And he actually did execute his wife at the time. Whereas, you know, in the movie, they kind of changed it for thematical elements.
Right.
And they changed it for dramatic purposes, really. But it is based on a real-life event that happened. Knowing that, while I went into this film, I was like, okay, so what really is going to happen?
You knew this before watching the movie.
Yeah, I knew.
You did.
I knew about the original story before I came into
it. Okay. Did that taint your viewing of the movie, knowing going in, or were you expecting maybe
really,
a different
because
outcome?
Because while I'm watching the movie, we see the true love from Max's character. Like, he is so torn over this. He truly loves his wife. He doesn't want to do anything to hurt her. He's willing to do high treason just so she stays alive, you know?
Right.
So I had never once in this film that I thought he was actually going to do harm to her. So once we saw the ending and that didn't happen, I was like, yeah, I believed it just because of what I watched on screen.
Yeah. I want to talk about the ending in a little bit. And I do agree with you that from Max's standpoint, from Max's viewpoint, I too agree that he was greatly in love with this woman. I just didn't buy it from the other side. I almost felt like it was calculated that if she was a spy, this is the perfect person for me to hook up with. And, oh, to sell this more, might as well have his, you know, we're going to get married. I'm going to have a kid, you know, and I may love the kid, but ultimately my goal is to get information to the Nazis. And this is the best way to do it because I'm in and I've got the best guy to be in with because of his position.
Guy that will protect her.
Yeah.
Literally.
And so, hence, my thing, I mean, we can talk about the end. I mean, she kills herself.
I saw that coming.
Yeah, same here. And I didn't... Reason being that the movie ended that way, they said, too, is... it was twofold. A, they wanted to show her love for Max and the child. Okay, and then following that scene, we have this scene that was very well shot. Like, her writing the letter, it was almost as if a ghost was writing this letter about, cool. "I love you, Max," and she writes this to prove that she really did love them. But I didn't buy it. Like, I didn't because she was still a spy. Like, someone who loves somebody that much would have stopped being a spy. Like, would have really loved that person for being who they were, but yet she still had him duped and was still selling off information, and she passed the blue dye exam. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, she failed it.
She failed it.
Yeah, all right. She failed it. So she was still using him in the disguise of being this person's wife. I didn't necessarily buy that. And as her showing of love.
Yeah, I mean, I can kind of understand what you're saying with that, because that scene where we see her write the letter and actually speak it out loud to the audience happened literally right after she shot herself.
Right.
But then probably 20 seconds on screen. So yeah. It went from her personal death to her personal letter
that she wrote because people. She sort of kind of knew what was coming.
I think emotionally I couldn't get there fast enough. Mm. Going from her death to love.
Right.
And I had a hard time connecting to that scene. But, like, I believe she was in love with Max, and she did have a love for her daughter. But it was just hard to get there and have it really be impactful after what just happened on screen.
Other than Brad Pitt's performance and breakdown and crying, yeah. And and whatnot. And then it had the footnote at the end of the movie where they were on that ranch. Obviously, mm-hmm. Time passed. You know, and he was with his daughter, his older daughter, and they were, you know, riding horses together.
And the color changed. Did you realize that? Uh-huh. It went from, like, that saturated gray to actual bright yellow green outside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, like, I kind of liked it kind of ended on a happier Absolutely. Note for his character.
Yeah, yeah. And it was done with the Zemeckis, you know, flair.
Charm.
You know, he, you know, people forget that this guy, or maybe they don't, but I will remind, you know, this guy invented technology. You know, he invented the camera that could put two people in a scene flawlessly without scenes, without having to film it. Like, you know, in Back to the Future Part 2, when actors had to play off one another, he also invented technology in Who Framed Roger Rabbit, you know, for how to have a camera, you know, on somebody and have people look as if they're actually interacting with a cartoon. You know, the guy is a visually stunning director. Forrest Gump has its great scenes. Were we talking about not too long ago, Castaway?
Yeah.
We were talking about Castaway, you and I, not too long ago. The movie Contact has some amazing flourishes. Even movies like What Lies Beneath, you know, the way he can move a camera.
He can visualize, yeah.
He's a great... I believe he's a great storyteller. You know, this one, while it had some of his visual flair, I just felt... I actually thought that the problem was more script than it was Zemeckis.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, my problem was this actual story. I think it was, I mean, I don't want to complain it was like too simple of a story, because a lot of times I do say this movie was, like a certain movie was easy to follow. This movie was a little too easy to follow.
Yeah.
And I don't feel like some of the stakes were high enough for me to be engaged for another hour and 40 minutes of the movie.
Yeah.
For something that we already know.
Sure. So let's talk a little bit about where Robert Zemeckis does talk about editing. Found this off of comingsoon.net. It was a really good interview. And he was asked, his movies themselves, do they change a lot in the editing room? And I found this fascinating because he says they change in the editing room, but I don't rearrange the story. He says, I'm a very meticulous filmmaker. I shoot exactly what I need. I don't shoot a bunch of stuff and then try to build the movie afterwards. I don't want to shoot any more than I absolutely have to. You know, that's a great insight.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he gets what he wants. He works with his second AD as well. And he works with the cinematographer. He's worked with Don Burgess. But I just love... how he, at this point in two in his career, you know, for how he started off working low-budget movies, I Want to Hold Your Hand, Used Cars, a great underappreciated comedy, very low budget, but when you're working with a low budget, you have to be more, you have to be a little, you have to get a thing in your feet. And then Back to the Future, when you see what he accomplished from a visual standpoint, and I just like the fact that he says, you know, he also worked in film. You could, in that era, you didn't want to shoot a ton because that instantly would raise your budget. Because if you were wasting film, your budget was becoming inflated. So I like how he says, now I'm very meticulous. I shoot what I need. And then in the editing room, that's all the pieces together.
And they actually kind of kept it simple for the actors, too, and just the how they executed everything for the production end of this. I didn't realize how much VFX actually went into this film.
A ton.
Out of 954 total shots, 776 of them involved effects.
Yeah.
And you know, while I'm watching it at the beginning of this film, you can easily tell like some more VFX shots, some are green screen, some are blue screen, especially when they were sitting in a car. And you had that rear projection behind them.
I noticed that too, but I was wondering, I'm so glad you brought that up. I was wondering if that was done on purpose.
Yeah, it was, because apparently it was easier for the actors to play off of against, and they had live time movement in the background, because they put up big LED monitors behind them and actually had film that they shot themselves projected on these screens during live time while they're acting.
Yeah, but I was taking it like that step further, because that's the way that movies were filmed. And it again, this movie oozes of that era of filmmaking, so to speak, which was great. Speaking of visual shots, the scene when they were at the cafe in Casablanca, actually shot in London. That was seamless to me.
They put that in a small town square.
Seamless.
It. You wouldn't know.
Nope.
Wouldn't know.
I also loved, and too, it's a great Robert Zemeckis opening. The movie opens up in the desert.
In the desert, yeah.
And then, you know, we just see the legs come flying down, and then the
parachute.
I was like,
that was a rough landing. When you're parachuting outside of whatever, you land on your butt, not your feet.
Yeah, I just like that scene. And then, you know, the Lawrence of Arabia as he's, you know, crossing the desert scene. Beautifully shot. And again, this is a movie, folks, that, like, dislike, yeah, you would have to agree that it was really well shot and looked amazing up on the big screen.
For sure it did. Some of the planes were, the planes themselves were CG, but they actually did build like a half of a rig of a plane that they lit on fire. Just for it. It was the close up.
Yep.
When we saw that plane crash down and almost hit them. That was the rig that they
That was a great scene, by the way. At the party,
That was great. Scary. I was like, it was. Y'all are just standing there watching this plane coming right towards you.
I was like, are you at least going to duck?
Yeah.
Or run?
I'd kind of run.
It was a good scene.
And fend for my life.
Really good scene.
It was pretty cool.
It was.
For the production aspect, they filmed on amazing cameras, which are like the Red Dragon.
Yes.
Holy crap. And you can definitely tell. It was the Red Dragon and Panavision Primo 70 lenses, and they shot it in true 6K.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Gorgeous. Again, gorgeous.
And that, again, too, is, you know, I credit Zemeckis and his, you know, longtime cinematographer, Don Burgess. They work so well together that it's like they can communicate without talking. So they know what they're looking for. And again, they're both men who come from film. So they are, you know, they're men who, like, you know, they know what it takes to edit, how to piece things together, how things look, you don't want to waste, how to light things. And in this particular movie, Don Burgess was saying that they had, there was a company, like the companies that they used, you know, were the visual effects company and the post company, there was sort of one entity. So he said it was great because I can do my visual effects, I can do my post, you know, and then I worked with like colorists and, you know, we got everything down. And he seems like a man that's, Zemeckis had been doing digital stuff now for a long time before digital became digital. Don Burgess seems to be very comfortable in the digital environment as to how he can make a movie look. I'll have to look it up. I believe he probably did, you know, Don Burgess probably did The Walk. But that movie, again, from a visual standpoint, you know, and the camera.
Beautiful.
If you don't have vertigo, you'd have it watching that movie. Watch that movie. You know, again, this is why I want to talk, you know, I think it's amazing what Zemeckis has accomplished in his career and what he's given movie-going audiences around the world as far as entertainment. I want to throw this question out. Why, you know, he's making movies like Allied or The Walk. They seem to be a little bit more personal stories. Movies like Flight. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm just wondering, is he at a time in his career where, and don't get me wrong, they're all original movies. I love watching them. But, you know, you figure, why doesn't a studio throw him another, like a franchise type of picture? I mean, he can definitely do it. Is it because he's too expensive? Does he want to do it? Is he too expensive? You know, we've talked. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, the thing is, just like Zemeckis built his career on like a really original concept. I mean, we had the whole Back to the Future trilogy and stuff. And what those movies did so well is that they showed a certain aspect of filming that no one has really accomplished yet. And he did that. And I think these more recent films of his, it's like he's getting away from like what's groundbreaking to like the actual true just storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
With, you know, the added effects with it. But, like, I felt like his earlier career was like, let's do something nothing nobody has done before and execute it well, and then we'll be remembered in that way. And now it's just getting back to, like, the roots of just good storytelling.
Yeah, and
personal stories.
And outside of Back to the Future, I can't think of any other Zemeckis's movies that were sequels. You know, I mean, Back to the Future, here's my wish. It's my Christmas wish, Mr. Zemeckis. I was fortunate enough to work with you on Contact, which I always stayed fantastic, wonderful. Not only for me was it a wonderful experience, everybody was just tremendous, and I was a kid in a candy store, but it's a great science fiction film, and you pulled out all your directional talents across the board, but I would love for you to work again with Bob Gale, because I argue that Back to the Future, and I believe it's been taught in schools, is one of the, if not near perfect, perfect screenplays that you have. And from a story point for a trilogy of movies, too, I think that Back to the Future ranks right up there with the original Star Wars trilogy, the original Indiana Jones trilogy. Like, those three trilogies, to me, are examples of really great storytelling. Mm-hmm. But Back to the Future, he and Bob Gale wrote everything out, and they wrote a beginning, a middle, and an end that really tied everything up so expertly and sweetly that it's hard to come by today to do that. The only people who I think are sort of doing it are the Marvel people and tying in all of their movies and franchises.
That's the problem with Hollywood right now, is that originality is lacking.
Yes.
That's why we have so many sequels now, because they're going off of stuff that's already established stories. They made a lot of money and they're bankable. But it's hard to find a good original story nowadays that can be the next, more say, potential trilogy. Not that even we wanted another trilogy or an extension of an already established franchise. It's just, it's hard to find original stories now.
Yeah, I mean, and
most of the movies we covered this year here on Anatomy of a Loan have been sequels.
And you know, to your point, Zemeckis agrees with you 100%. In an interview that he did with The Atlantic, he was asked about original storytelling. And he says, when you know, you don't see movies like this, like Allied. And he goes, I'm very concerned that we don't make movies that are original anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think the only thing filmmakers can do is try to make a good movie, or try to make good movies, and make them as long as they allow us to keep making them. But at the end of the day, it's a business. And if audiences don't care, there's nothing we can do. I'll just go away, I guess. I don't want you to go away.
I'm glad he says that, because then I think you and I would get along, Robert Zemeckis.
Yeah, you know, I agree with him.
I completely agree,
and
too.
And you know, prior to this, we talked about we were doing Manchester by the Sea, a completely different movie from Allied, but yet an original story. I don't want these original stories going away. You know, there are plenty out there, and you know, I want Robert Zemeckis to be given more projects, so that, you know, maybe Allied wasn't a home run. I'd give it, maybe it was a double, okay, but I'd still like to see. I still think he has a lot more in him, you know. And again, he comes from a time when the word franchise, people didn't think Back to the Future was going to work.
Yeah.
And when you watch Back to the Future, that movie has a clear beginning, middle, and end. Okay? He saves the day. They do whatever. And if Back to the Future didn't work, there wouldn't have been a 2 and or a 3. You know, you couldn't finish off that trilogy. That's why filmmakers used to just try to make one good movie. And if audiences liked the movie, he had a good opening weekend and a good long run, the studio said, got to make a sequel. Where today, they're more like, well, how do I make a sequel to Allied? How do we franchise this picture?
He marries another woman who's also a spy, too.
He becomes a spy. Or, Shoot. Or Hitler comes after Max. I mean, you can't, is the answer. That's not really a bad thing in today's Hollywood. So,
I think this movie stands alone. It does stand alone.
Yeah.
It doesn't warrant a sequel, because I don't think anyone would want a sequel out of this.
Yeah.
Because it had a beginning, it had a middle, and definitely had an end. But I don't think Robert Zemeckis, just to like keep working, he needs to do another franchise. He's right. Already done it.
Yeah.
So like, I think he's at his point in a career where he can just do literally whatever kind of movie he wants.
Yep.
And be fine.
Yeah, and like I said, he's always been an innovator. In fact, if memory serves, if somebody can look this up for me, back in the 80s, maybe it was early 90s, he did create the first interactive movie ever. I remember this in Boston, where basically there was a movie. Everybody in their seat had had like a remote control. And as the movie was going, a certain signal would come up where the audience would say what would happen next. And it was done by it was a computer, so it was quick tally. So you had like 1, 2, or 3, and then the audience, you know, then the movie would go in that direction.
Oh, I like that.
So, you know, it never really took off. I remember it taking place at the Copley Theater in Boston. And this was a Zemeckis-produced thing. Now, it didn't exactly work, but this was like in the 80s. This was like the early 90s. He was thinking interactive before interactive became a word when it comes to movies. This is why he's an innovator, and this is why, for me, he's very beloved in the canon of great movies.
I think that's what also makes just a story fun, because you watch that more than once, it's going to be a different ending every single time. It's kind of like the Mystery of Edwin Drood.
Sure.
That, you know, the audience gets to choose which pair ends up together.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And that changes every single time.
Yeah.
I like that. That's fun.
Yeah. I forget the movie. We could look it up in the booth. It came out like somewhere in the 90s. I believe he produced it. But and while maybe that's happening, let's talk about, because I brought it up, let's talk about costumes. I know costumes is something you love.
I do.
You talk about it. And again, Joanna Johnston is very near and dear to my heart. She was one of the sweetest, kindest people to be part of her team. And I was just the PA, okay? But she and her crew made me feel like I was part of a team. And I know nothing about costumes. If you watch me on this show and see how I dress. Okay. But in this movie, I was surprised to find out she was only given 2 weeks of prep time.
Wow.
To research this movie.
Out of everyone who has to look like they're in the 40s.
And not only that, she's not just costuming our leads, our beautiful leads, by the ways.
Right.
She's got the supporting cast, all of the extras, everybody, the military men, mm-hmm. everybody who is in the movie has a costume that she's got to work with military advisors. And
even their ranks,
the ranks. Know, oh, you got to make medals. Them right.
Yeah, you got to do that too.
Yeah, and
I think they look gorgeous, especially like the color palette for both of them. Because overall, this movie visually was a bit saturated.
Sure.
Really like kind of cold color yeah. tones. So to have a purple dress stand out at the beginning, to go to a lighter sky blue kind of color. So like just. Marianne's wardrobe throughout the whole film already evolved, you know?
Right. Well, you know, it's funny that you mentioned the purple dress, because she goes from wearing this purple dress to a green dress in the shootout scene. But Joanna Johnson, and this comes from, of all places, Harper's Bazaar. Yes. I turn, no stone goes unturned. I will read an article from Harper's Bazaar. And they had a long debate about the color of that dress because the Americans called it purple. And all of us here in England, she is a Brit, call it midnight blue. And there was a lot of discussion about it because the guy in the car with Max has to say what color that dress is. Like, if you remember,
yeah,
she is wearing a purple dress. It's the only way he's going to recognize her. And what did he say? Something about a bird, a hummingbird. So two sides of the Atlantic had two different opinions. And I wanted her to look sexy, beautiful, but not in a base sexy way. So we put the sex appeal in the back because I knew we were going to see her first from the back. Which, again, these are details that, like, this is what I love talking about.
You gotta remember,
and about.
Like, his character, Max.
Yeah.
And he's from Toronto. So, yeah. What color would he understand the most to look out for?
Yeah. And for those who may be interesting, it was a beautiful Italian fabric, very fine, very delicate silk with all this silver shimmer through it. It's really pretty for the nighttime. But I just found that there was, well, we call it midnight blue. Us Americans call it purple. So, I thought that was very fascinating.
That's neat.
Yeah. You know, and Joanna was inspired by old Hollywood films of that era.
Definitely could see that.
Mm-hmm. Wardrobes of Lauren Bacall, Barbara Stanwyck, Catherine
Hepburn.
I got
a Lauren Bacall feeling in this movie.
Didn't you totally at certain times?
Especially like how her hair was cut and how it was coiffed in this movie. Totally Lauren.
Yeah, even to in a sense of, she Catherine Hepburn... it was huge. She looked at Casablanca, not just for the sheer settings, because it has that great timeless quality. And this I have to say about the costumes. Again, I'm not in vogue at all, but a lot of the sweaters or whatever, or jackets that Brad Pitt was wearing, I'd go, yeah, I'd wear that today if I could. Like, that looks, it is timeless.
Fashion
it's a great
hasn't
era.
Changed.
No, it hasn't to an extent, but it is a timeless era. You know, it's one of the, yeah, it's.
His suits look amazing.
His suits look great.
There were so many times where Marianne was like, you're in a suit. You're in a different suit, you know. Go, why are you dressed up?
And right.
Like, he looked great in every single shade of color his suits were.
Right. Yeah. Now, I thought costuming, again, it's a great time. Even if you watch Casablanca, which is in black and white.
I love that film.
You see
the German wore gray,
yep.
You wore blue.
Yeah.
Yes.
it is a timeless period. I hope that she gets recognized in one way, shape, or form for her work and allied. You know, it could potentially
be. Do you think she get nominated?
It might be one of the only ones outside of potential visual effects work, but she could. Right now, nothing else really jumps to mind.
She might, maybe against La La Land.
Yeah, but. I mean, it'll be interesting. I hope so. Someday, Joanna, I'm with you. If I had any say, you would have won the Academy Award a long, long time ago. And she's worked with the greats. She's worked with people like Spielberg. So she knows her stuff.
Good for her.
And I do say good for her. And, I wish, it's she's in England. It would be great to reach out. I'd love to have her on the show. I'd love to talk to her about just
maybe
her career.
For a Future Anatomy.
Yeah, so
throw that out there.
Somebody pass that out to her. That we'd love to have her on the show.
Putting it out into the universe.
So, do we want to talk a little bit about reception and such?
Before we do that, let's talk a little bit about the music.
Yeah, another.
You're always score. You and I are probably the biggest on the music. Every single Anatomy.
Yes.
Alan Silvestri, who's worked with Zemeckis so many times. This is their 16th collaboration together.
Yeah.
For large parts, it was a very small, low key score.
It was.
And what they used for temp tracks in this movie was Castaway. Castaway music.
Uh huh.
For temp tracks. Yeah. I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah. And as I was watching, it was a very low-key score. Like, even in scenes where you would think that score was going to enhance suspense or whatever, score in this movie was very subtle. But it had the Alan Silvestri flair to it. Like, I just knew. I go, oh, this has to be Alan Silvestri. Mm-hmm. And he's such a great collaborator again with Zemeckis. The guy's no slouch when it comes to scoring movies, and I thought that it was well done.
Right. I think one moment of the movie that I like, or maybe two moments, that I really, really noticed it was when the plane was crashing down and almost killed them.
Oh, yeah.
All.
Yeah.
That I think that was like really bombastic. And then also when they go to the jeweler, the shady jeweler guy, and he takes him out,
You mean when they go to the shop?
Yeah.
Right.
And Marianne's literally just sitting in the car, and there's really no dialogue for a full minute, which was painful to watch. But only the music was underlying that, built that suspense of what is happening right now.
It was very, very, it was very well done. And you're right, it went on for a while. I mean, that was...
A little too long.
That was one of the things that... I guess in a sense that built suspense, tried to build suspense. And in a case where we sort of kind of knew she was the spy. So I'm trying to find what this movie may have been. But, it's funny. This is also a guy, he directed that movie Death Becomes Her. That with Meryl Streep and Goldie Hawn, and that too was one of the things, the first time where we see where somebody gets shot. And you see through the person, guy. Yeah.
That's a great film. If you were ever to do a retrospective on a film, I would love to cover that one, too.
Yeah, and he produced, for you folks, Tales from the Crypt. Mm. It was one of the HBO long-running series that became a couple of movies. This guy has done... his bit for King and Queen, whether it be TV and whatnot. He's a very, listen, what can you do? I mean, the guy's been around forever. He deserves whatever accolades he gets later on in life and going forward. He's earned his cred. Mm-hmm. So now, was there anything else that we missed before we start talking about budgets and reception and
no, I think
and such? So the movie had come out on December 6th, Paramount, and...
Actually, it came out the 23rd.
Was it the 23rd of... was the 23rd of November?
We were a little late to this dissection,
It was 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, it came out released November 23rd.
Wow, we are late on this dissection. Yeah, wow, so you know what that means? We'll have higher ratings because more people have seen the movie and want to talk about it.
That's true.
The way I look at it. So
true.
$85 million budget, which... Just for a production budget, for a World War II time period movie...
It's high.
I think it's low. Really? I think for a period piece movie with all of the sets that you would have to do, I thought 85, I would have figured at least 100. But when you factor in hard drives and advertising and stuff, then you get over, 100. You probably, you know, you get over 100. It, let's see, on Rotten Tomatoes, we're looking at 61%. Mm-hmm. Which is one of the rare times.
Terrible.
No.
It's not terrible. The audience is 71.
Yeah.
So, and it's a little bit higher. Cinema score is B.
It's a B.
Which, that's kind of low. Do you agree with that?
Wait, a B?
A B for this movie.
I was going to go BB plus.
Yeah, I would say B plus.
And I would say for a 61%, if I were going percentage-wise, I might give it a 70. You know, okay. I don't think it was like... Again, I found the movie to be enjoyable. I had hoped for it to be better because of the talent involved, and because I will always be rooting for Robert Zemeckis, it didn't reach like those heights for me. But regardless, it's still a good movie to be seen on a big screen. Like, it's
gorgeous.
Just because of the way that it's shot.
Did you see this film in IMAX? Was it even in IMAX?
No, I didn't. Yeah, but I didn't know. I didn't.
Gorgeous. Especially with the air raids and all the bombing. It would have been amazing in an IMAX.
I got to bring this up, too, about the air raids and the bombings. They weren't too dark. As an audience, you were able to see pretty much everything happening, whether we're in the foreground or in the background. I thought that was great. The scene with the plane was great too, because that's a great Robert Zemeckis flair, because they're looking up, one of the party members goes, "All right, we got one." Mm-hmm. And then you see the plane just start careening and coming down, and they're like going, "Oh wait, we got one. We got like, what are we gonna do?"
Right.
And the fire, it was a great scene. When you break it down. So there's much to applaud about the movie. And if you hadn't seen it and you're watching us, all right, so you already know the plot. But if you have seen it, what did you think about the movie? Tell us what you thought visually, mm-hmm. from a direction standpoint. I wasn't bored.
Because I was really, needless to say, I was intrigued by the story. I kind of wanted like a little twist at the end. Like, what if she wasn't a spy? And all this was for naught, you know? Like, I think that would have been cool. But the whole slow build-up, him going to, like, this person, and then this person, and then this person, just to learn a little bit more about her, and to confirm his doubts and mm-hmm. stuff. But, like, I think it was a slow burn of figuring out all these things about who this person is, which we already knew.
Yeah, one other plot.
He was a little too slow to get there.
Yeah, one plot point though that I do want to bring up, because it was a tragic plot point. He finds that airman. He finds that pilot.
Yeah.
And he says, "Hey, when you go there, give you this, and I want you to ask him about this person. This is confidential. This is just you." And the guy's like, "Okay, you know, I'll do that for you. All right, fly safe."
Nope.
And then we come to find out that, because he sent him on that mission, because of Max's decision to do that, that pilot crashed, burned, got killed.
Yeah.
And I found that to be like a decent part of the story, that maybe his obsession with this, it's seeping out, where it's not just affecting him, but
it's affecting other people.
And he too, being an airman, you know, can feel the tragic loss of this young soldier,
the camaraderie.
Yeah.
And like, I like how you brought that up too, because it shows that not only is he affected, but other people have died because of this woman.
Yeah.
And he was now solely like in blame, at fault for someone else's death because of his wife.
Right. Yeah, it was a very interesting scene.
And I felt bad for the guy, because...
How could you not?
Once they established him, he was already nervous as all hell, just to go on, be behind enemy lines for the first time, and then give him a confidential mission that literally gets him killed.
Yeah.
Was just like, he obviously did not deserve that.
Yeah, it was an interesting plot point to put into the movie.
Made it more personal.
It made it more personal. Yep. So, well, I think we've talked. We've gone up, down, front, center, yep. right, left, about Allied.
And round.
And so why don't we begin to wrap this up? Final thoughts on Allied, Marissa?
I enjoyed it. If you like a visual spectacle, watch this film. Definitely. If you like a good thriller about, you know, just like a good thriller story, watch this film.
Yeah.
If you're looking for like a completely crazy film that you think a lot's going to happen, don't watch this film.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, I would
overall,
say
I enjoyed it.
If you want to see filmmaking done from a bygone era that mixes today's technology, this is a movie to go see. If you're a film nut, you're a film historian and geek like we are here, you'll enjoy aspects of this movie because you'll go, oh, okay, I get the Casablanca. Oh, okay, this is a little Hitchcockian. Oh, Lawrence of Arabia.
I'm going to watch Casablanca again.
You'll appreciate that. You'll appreciate the aspects and the time and detail that Zemeckis put into making it like that movie. Mm-hmm. And it is an original story. So there we go. We've wrapped up on Allied. Please stay tuned because in the coming weeks, we have movies like La La Land. We're getting into the award season. Then we got this tiny film Rogue One, which comes out in about a week's time. You know, we have Passengers at some point. Then we've got Nocturnal Animals. We've got Fences. We've got all of these movies that we will be getting to at some point in time. So be allies with us. And continue to watch movies and continue to tune in. Thank you very much for all your help and support and comment. Take care. We'll see you guys at the movies.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff, we would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.